This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. And as I said just a moment ago, our guest for this first hour of the show is Ken Turan. He's film critic at the Los Angeles Times, has been reviewing films for the LA Times for 15 years. He can also be heard weekly as film critic for National Public Radio's Morning Edition. He is also the editor of the LA Times Book Prizes. He makes his home in Los Angeles. He's talking with us by phone. And we will indeed be talking about some of the movies that you can find in his new book, Now in Theaters Everywhere, A Celebration of a Certain Kind of Blockbuster. That is the subtitle. It is published by Public Affairs. And you can certainly find it in the bookstore now, as well as some of his other books. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you would like to call into the program, is 333-9455. And we also do have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. No pledging will be required. We hope that people do pledge, of course, to the station, but that's a separate number and a separate thing. If you want to join our conversation here this morning, you can call, and that's what will happen. Again, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Ken Turan, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's always a pleasure to be here.
Well, we certainly appreciate it. I think as soon as people here around here got wind of the fact that I was going to be talking with you and we'll be talking about this book, there started to be some kind of raging debate about, well, what exactly do we mean by blockbuster? So maybe I'll ask you right up front for a definition of the term. For you, what exactly does that mean?
Well, what it means for me is a film that is, well, I should say it's an intention to be a blockbuster. Some of these films never made blockbuster money. But to me, a blockbuster, what I have in mind with this book is the films that were made by major studios with all the stars and the resources that we associate traditionally with Hollywood films. You know, these are kind of the movies that we think of. And when we think of going to the movies, we think these are the movies. This is what we're going to. Unfortunately, more and more, it's become the case that these movies are rare. They're not the movies anymore. The movie business has really changed in our lifetime.
Well, what for these particular movies, and I've looked down the list here, and actually as I look at some of these movies, one of the things that surprises me, and I say that because I have this feeling that I don't go to the movies a lot. My wife and I, we talk about going, but somehow we don't manage to get there. I've seen a lot of these movies and would agree that I thought that they were entertaining and were pretty good films. You can have big stars, you can have a big budget, you can have a lot of special effects, and you can make a bad movie. So what is it, do you think, that with this kind of movie, is it actually possible to say what makes the difference between a successful film, one that's really good, that's very entertaining, that people like, that actually also makes money, and one that just falls flat?
You know, if you could exactly quantify it, there'd be nothing but hits out of Hollywood. But there are tendencies, there are things, and, you know, it feels funny mentioning them because they seem so obvious. People think, well, of course they're going to be doing this, but they're not doing this. There are two things that come to my mind, and they're kind of linked. One of them is writing. These films, the ones that are good, are often really well written. They have good scripts. They have not been monkeyed with or destroyed. They're smart, intelligent scripts. And the other thing is, and this is rarer still, even though you'd think it would be a given, these films have a respect for the intelligence of the audience. They don't think they're making movies for the dumbest people in America, or that all people who go to movies in America are really dumb and you can't have anything too intelligent in there. These are films that respect the intelligence of the viewer, and that is a rare thing.
Hmm. You begin by including a short, relatively short, because most of what we have here are really capsule reviews of the movies, a short piece about the film Blade Runner, which I thought was really interesting. It is one of those movies that some people never got from the beginning. I'm not sure the people at the studio ever really got it, but it's had a very loyal following of people who, when they saw the movie for the first time, they thought, here, this is something special. This is something that we've never seen before. Even though, as you explain in this piece, the director, Ridley Scott, didn't get to... It wasn't the movie he wanted to make. Now there is a director's cut, so you can actually see pretty much the movie he wanted to make. But the one that was that went out in theaters, that really wasn't what he had in mind. In spite of that fact, a lot of people loved the movie. So I'm interested in why you included that piece and how thinking about Blade Runner and, you know, how it was made and what it went through, how that contributes to thinking about what makes or breaks up one of these kind of movies.
Well, Blade Runner is a fascinating case because it's a film that, you know, it's a film that wouldn't die. And in fact, believe it or not, it is being re-released both theatrically and within a new DVD version in the new year. So this is a film that still the studio feels has drawing power. It's a film that, as you say, went through a lot of obstacles, initially came out in a way that the director didn't like, but it had such strength in terms of its visuals and in terms of the way it conceptualized the future. You know, this was not a utopian future. In the film shows, it's a dystopian future. And as I walk around Los Angeles, I'm thinking all the time, the city's becoming to look more and more like Blade Runner. I mean, it was a really strong vision, and that's what people who connected to the film connected to. There were disadvantages to the film because the film tested badly. They put a voiceover in it. They had Harrison Ford reading a narration, which was a terrible idea and really hurt the film, and that's gone now in the new versions. So it just shows how tricky, how complicated it can be to get a really good film. It's like a very complicated pool shot, you know, that has to bounce off of, you know, all four sides of the table before it hits the ball. Yeah. These things are very tricky to make, and this is a real interesting, for me, case history on how what went into making this film, the pitfalls, the ones they surmounted, the ones they didn't.
Well, and it's certainly a case where you can see that when someone has a vision, in this particular case, Ridley Scott, he had this vision, and he particularly was interested in a certain look. He had this idea of what he wanted it to look like and was very much involved in the look of the picture. You can, it's a story of how difficult it is for, if you have, you know, if you're a director, you have in your mind something you want to get on the screen, how difficult that is, and what a struggle it can be. And apparently there were a lot of fighting with the crew, and he wanted things a certain way, and they didn't want to do it. And then, of course, the suits, the people at the studio, they looked at the movie and they thought, what is this?
They tested
with the audience, and you know, some people didn't. There's things they didn't like about this, so they fooled around with it and tried to make it better. And it's just a great story about how difficult it is for you to, if you're a director, you think this is the movie I want to make. How many things there are that get in your way?
Oh yeah, and you know, it's also fascinating. You know, I did a lot of interviewing with people who work with Ridley Scott, and you know, it's so interesting. They have kind of a divided feeling about the film. On the one hand, they are so happy to have worked on a film that is undeniably a great film and to have worked with a genius, which is the way they think about Ridley Scott. But the actual day-to-day working on the film drove them crazy. Yeah. They kind of were suicidal. It was so, you know, we all talk about how great it would be to work with someone with vision, but someone with vision can be demanding and uncompromising. And, you know, at a certain point, the crew all wore T-shirts that said, Will Rogers never met with Ridley Scott, you know, a reference to the quote that, well, I never met a man I didn't like. You know, this is the level that the rebellion on the crew took. But so, you know, it's very interesting to see that working with a great genius can be a difficult proposition.
Yeah. You know, something that I did, and I don't know if this means anything in particular, but there's an index in the back of the book that lists all of the films. So if you're looking for a title and you want to find it, you can look it up. But it also lists names. And so this would be the names of the performers in the movies and also some of the directors. And just, I was curious to see who merited the most mentions. And on the director side, there are a handful that have several mentions, and Ridley Scott is one of them. And I was also interested, and Steven Spielberg is also one, so maybe that wouldn't really surprise you, but that there are three others that are on this list that I think are interesting because they're there and also because they're not really the names that people think of as big, high-profile blockbuster directors. Barry Levinson is one, Spike Lee is another, and Michael Mann is the third. And now, so I don't know if it really means particularly anything that these guys, in addition to Ridley Scott, get a lot of mentions in the book. Does that say something, the fact that a number of films by these directors are included in this collection?
Well, it means that these directors really have a drive towards quality. You know, not just a drive to making whatever's next, a drive to whatever they can put together. They are all strong-minded people, and they have a particular way they see film. It's an intelligent vision, and they have the strength of mind to put it forward. You know, one other name that you didn't mention that I think is worth bringing up, because even though we take it for granted now, if you would have said 20 years ago that this man's name would be in here, people would have looked at you like you needed to be institutionalized, and that's Clint Eastwood.
Yes, he's on both of these lists, both the list on frequently mentioned actors and frequently mentioned directors. That is absolutely right.
The fact that he has turned into, and we're seeing it again with Flags of Our Fathers, his latest film, I mean, the fact that he's turned into really one of the most respected directors in the world, someone whose vision everyone agrees is just really remarkable, is somebody I grew up watching him on TV, watching him as the ramrod Rowdy Yates on Rawhide. And if you would have said to me, this guy is going to turn into one of the great directors, I would have said, you're out of your mind. But he has.
Yeah. And he's one of these guys that in a sort of an old-fashioned Hollywood sense, I think he's really got screen presence. If I'm sitting in front of the television and I'm flippering around, if a Clint Eastwood movie comes on and you know, I don't have to be somewhere, I will sit there and I will watch it, even if it's a movie that I have seen more than once. And I think probably most of his movies I've seen at least one time and probably more than once.
He has that remarkable quality, that really makes him excel in screen acting. You know, it's not like you'd want to see him on stage. You wouldn't necessarily want to see him doing Hamlet. But when he is on screen, he holds your interest. He has that intensity, that presence, and the skill and the craft to know how to use it, that you if you're flipping channels and he comes on, you stop flipping. You know, he is just a great, great film actor.
Yeah. You mentioned his new film that's just been in the theaters, I think, for about a week.
Right.
Flags of Our Fathers. And you reviewed it for the L.A. Times, and I know that you thought that it was a good film. Like, it's been doing well with critics. I just read an article this morning saying, however, that the box office was not particularly great the first weekend, which shows you that that's one of the challenges films have these days. They're so expensive. If they don't make a lot of money right out of the gate, they're considered to be a failure. So this movie cost $90 million in the first weekend. They made a little over 10. So now the studio apparently is thinking, oh, gosh, we think it's a good film. Critics like it, but it's not doing all that well with audiences.
Yeah. I mean, and the studios know better, you know, because if the other thing that these stories say is that this film isn't basically following the pattern that Eastwood's films follow. Eastwood films open slowly. The audience is adults. I think the exit poll said that 80% of the audience for this film in the opening weekend was 30 and over, which is just the flip of what it usually is. And adults have other responsibilities. They have complicated lives. Adults don't rush off to a film the first weekend the way kids do. And so these films, by their nature, open slowly and build slowly as people's friends say, I saw the new Eastwood film, it's really good. People make time for it in their schedules. They build slowly, and even though the studios know that this is the case and they know they have to wait, they are so kind of conditioned to the immediate kind of rush of first weekend profit that it's hard for them to be patient and to wait.
Mm-hmm. I guess one of the things that it underscores, and you can see it in some of the movies that are in this book, is just how expensive movies have become to make, and how that and that also, as I said, that means that the studios, they've spent all this money, they want to see it making money immediately. If that doesn't happen, then quickly movies can be dumped and in favor of what the next thing is, because they think, okay, that one didn't make the money, but this next thing is going to, so let's get that out there, get that in the theater. And movies don't much have a chance to grow and find audiences anymore. And that does indeed, I think, mostly have to do with the fact that it's just, for a movie like this, for a big movie, it costs a tremendous amount of money.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, I mean, this film costs a lot, and the average cost of a major studio film, if you factor in prints and advertising, is around $100 million. Now, $100 million, if you stop and think about it, is a huge amount of money. I mean, I sometimes think every studio in America should vow to make one less movie a year and give that $100 million, to education or to their local school district or something. Think of the good that could do. But instead, they just make other movies, and because they cost so much, the drive is to make them for their most reliable audience. Their most reliable audience is young people, and that's why you get films like Pirates of the Caribbean, where if you spend a lot of money, you can immediately get a lot of money back.
In the book, I should mention, your new book, now in theaters everywhere, it lists a number of movies, suggestions for people who are looking for movies that they might have missed first time around, in different categories: action, thriller, comedy, drama, romance, animation, and spectacle. And I think there's probably something here for almost anybody. Just off the top of your head, just to give people an idea what sort of movies are in here, you want to mention just a few?
Sure. I mean, and again, you know, the idea of this book is, as you say, to be useful. You know, the idea is that people, you know, one of the things I found in writing these books and in talking to people, people love movies. It's like they, people who are, you know, have been in love a lot and still want to fall in love again, but they're nervous that they're going to get burned. And people don't want to waste time on bad films. They want to see ones that are going to satisfy them. And hopefully this book will help them find them. One of the ones, you know, one of the more recent ones, Inside Man, you mentioned Spike Lee. This was really one of the most commercial films Spike Lee had done in a long time. It's about a kind of a perfect crime, a bank robbery. It's very fast-paced. It's smart. It's funny. It's exciting. It's really a treat to see. Oh, gosh, there are so many here. Bowfinger is one that popped into mind, a comedy with Steve Martin and Eddie Murphy, kind of a satire on Hollywood, which was very, very amusing. You know, the whole animation category is filled with films. You know, we think these films are for children, but really John Lasseter, who runs Pixar, is a big believer in having films that do not insult adults' intelligence. Mm. And you've got the Toy Story films, you've got, you know, ones that he didn't do. You've got the Wallace and Gromit movies, you've got Shrek, Lilo and Stitch. They're great spectacle movies. I mean, one of the things, you know, Lord of the Rings films ended up being hugely successful. They made hundreds of millions of dollars, but they were a tough call. It took a while to get them financed. People said, well, this is not going to work. One of the things that made them so successful was that there are intelligent scripts and there was good acting in these films, and that's very rare for spectacle films. So I think all three of those, if you've missed them because you thought they weren't for you, are definitely worth your time.
Yeah, it makes me, one of the things that makes me think about when you look at these films is that if you look at some of them, you look at the subject matter, the kind of film it is, it's not that nobody ever made a movie like that before. So it's not as if they were reinventing the wheel. And yet something about the movie seemed fresh, as if you had really never seen it before. And I'm not sure what, you know, what that is, if it's, as you say, it's some kind of quality of a mix of the performers and the story and how well written it is and the look. Because in some cases, I think it really is that you're confronted with something and you just say, I have never seen anything like that before.
Yeah, it's just very satisfying. You know, one of the things I think also that we forget, because so many people kind of finagle their way into feature directing through, you know, through contacts, through influence, through being successful producers, there is such a thing as directing skill. There is such a thing as being a natural filmmaker. I mean, we have a man working right now named Christopher Nolan who did the last Batman movie, whose new film, The Prestige, is out there. Every one of his films has been interesting. Every one of his films has been really worth watching and fascinating. He's just a gifted director. And a lot of the films in this book are by gifted directors. And we forget that there is such a thing because so many people kind of, you know, finagle their way into making films and they turn out to be terrible.
Yeah, I think it's interesting the emergence of Michael Mann, who I suppose some people will remember Miami Vice and will associate him with that. But he in the past few years, he's made a number of really interesting, very stylish thriller kind of movies. And that's maybe his name was not going to be on a lot of people's list of directors that they know or that they think about.
Yeah, no, Michael Mann is a really meticulous filmmaker. He's very gifted. He knows exactly what he wants. He is in the Ridley Scott mold. He is, you know, really demanding. He knows what he wants, and he knows how to get it. But the films really, really pay off. There, you really get that, you know, you get value for that. Heat is in the book. It's one of the, you know, really underrated, I think, thriller. He does other kinds of films. The Insider, film about the tobacco industry and its attempt to kind of squelch the knowledge that cigarettes cause cancer. His films really grab you. They're very intense. They're very well made. They're really faultlessly made. And whenever I see his name on a film, I want to see it. I look forward to it. You know, win, lose, or draw, I know there's going to be something of interest in there, and you're really going to get your money's worth.
Our guest this morning, Kenneth Turan. He's a film critic whose reviews appear regularly on National Public Radio on Morning Edition. He is also writes for the Los Angeles Times and has been a film critic there, the LA Times, for 15 years. And you can certainly find his review. You can actually go online if you want to read his reviews on the Times. And he's also authored a number of books. The one that here we're talking about this morning, Now in Theaters Everywhere, A Celebration of a Certain Kind of Blockbuster. So if you're looking for some suggestions about, you know, a good popular movie, big-time Hollywood movie, something that would be a lot of fun, you can look at this book. Also, I do want to mention his previous book because it's kind of a companion in a sense, but the intent is different, and that is a listing of smaller films, could be foreign language films, independent films that you might have missed because you never actually even got a chance to see them. And that book was published in 2004, and the title is Never Coming to a Theater Near You, A Celebration of a Certain Kind of Movie. So you can look for both of those books in the bookstore. And also here, people who are listening to us, if you have questions, you can join us. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, I did that same kind of thing with we had talked about earlier where I looked at how many mentions the directors got. I did the same thing for the actors. And one of those that is actually gets a lot of mentions, and perhaps it's because he's, as we've said, he's both an actor and director, is Clint Eastwood. But I also thought it was interesting, and again, I'm not exactly sure what this means other than some of these guys have had very long careers. But the actors that come up again and again, in addition to Clint Eastwood, Tom Cruise, maybe no surprise, also Harrison Ford, Gene Hackman, Tommy Lee Jones, Denzel Washington, Robert Redford. Now, there again, and maybe it's just that all of these guys have been in a lot of movies and in good ones. Does it mean something that those actors are the ones who seem to have so many mentions?
Well, what it says, I think, you know, one of the things that people don't realize about actors is that there are two separate abilities an actor has to have. One is the ability to act, obviously, but there's some very good actors who don't really have a sense of what they should be in, who don't really have good taste in material, as they say in the business. And these actors, the one you mentioned, I think Denzel Washington really most of all, these actors have a really strong taste in material. They know what a good film is. They know what a good role for them is. And so if you see that they're in a film, you know there's some reason to watch. There are some wonderful actors that I could mention, but I won't because it would be impolite, you know, who are enormously talented and don't have a clue what they should be in and end up in a series of dreadful films. And if you see their name on a picture, you say, well, is this going to be one of the good ones or one of the bad ones? Yeah, if you see Denzel Washington's name on a film, you know it's going to be worth seeing. Even if it's not going to be your favorite film of the year, you're not going to be unhappy that you've gone.
Mm-hmm. For no particular reason other than one of the guys' names on this list is Harrison Ford, is there going to actually be another Raiders of the Lost Ark?
That is the $64 million question. Both Harrison Ford and Steven Spielberg say that there will be, that they're just trying, and George Lucas, they're just trying to get, you know, the right script, and they're trying to get everyone's schedules together. I think it's a 50-50 chance, not because anyone's lying, but because these things are so complicated and people's schedules and the financing get so tricky and people get older and, you know, how much action stuff can they do. I think people want to do another one. Whether it will actually happen is really anyone's guess, but it's definitely in the works. They're trying to make it happen, but sometimes trying isn't enough.
Yeah. The movies on this list, I think, are within about the last, I don't know, decade or so, about the last 10 years?
10, 15 years, yeah.
Okay. And there may be other movies that other people would like to nominate that go back a little further. Do you remember what the first movie you saw that you would say really made an impression on you was? The first one that you saw, you just thought it just changed your life, it knocked you out completely?
Oh, so you're talking about when I was a kid, when I started
when you first started going to the movies. Yeah.
Well, you know which one really, you know, the oddest films sometimes make impressions on you. One that I remember very vividly from my childhood was an Italian, a dubbed Italian version of The Odyssey called Ulysses that starred Kirk Douglas in the starring role, as you know, the traveler who left the Trojan Wars and made his way back to his family. And it was very vivid, a lot of great, you know, for the time, special effects. It was very exciting. It took me to a complete other world I'd never even dreamed about. I must have been, you know, 9 or 10 years old or something when I saw it. And I said, boy, this is really exciting. I want to see more like this.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. My wife and I were talking about this last night, and she sort of suggested I should ask you this particular question. And then we started talking about could we remember the first movie we ever saw? And actually, I had to say, I would have no idea. I'm not really sure how far back I can remember having gone to the movies. I'm sure I've saw a lot of movies. My long-suffering father took my sister and I to an awful lot of movies, many of which I think he couldn't have cared less about. But, you know, I don't know even if I could say what I thought was the earliest movie memory I have.
Well, you know, one of the memories I have that it's always amusing to me is I saw a lot of movies on TV. There was a program, I grew up in New York, there was a program called Million Dollar Movie. And they had a lot of really great old Hollywood films on there, and I watched that a lot. And so I'll tell you a funny story. The program had a theme song, and, you know, it was a certain kind of music, and I associated that with Million Dollar Movie. And for whatever reason, you know, sometimes you catch up to films later in life rather than sooner, and a film I did not really see till I was in my 30s, and it was reissued, was Gone with the Wind.
Hmm.
And Gone with the Wind starts, and the orchestra starts to play, and the thought that runs through my mind is, oh, my God, Gone with the Wind stole the theme from Million Dollar Movie. Because when I had watched it, I had no idea that Million Dollar Movie had stolen the theme from Gone with the Wind.
Well, you know, when I grew up in the Chicago area and grew up watching WGN, which had a really fine classic, you know, golden age Hollywood film collection, the kind of things now today you only see on Turner Classics because I guess someone's decided that no one will watch a black and white movie anymore.
I know, it's a shame, but, you know, these are wonderful, wonderful films.
And that was when I first would have seen things like, we're watching Fred Astaire and The Maltese Falcon and those kinds of things. And I'm sure that I saw plenty of those cloak and sandal epics. Those some of those movies, particularly those Italian movies, where all the sound effects and the dialogue was all dubbed in.
Yeah, yeah.
The way they made the movies at that time. I also want to tell people, by the way, listening, if somebody, we're just nattering on here, if somebody wants to call in, we certainly would be happy to have a call. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Ken Turan is talking with us. He's film critic for the LA Times and also reviews movies for NPR's Morning Edition. If you'd like to call in here, you certainly may. Is there something, some things that you know will be coming out here? Now we're getting into what is going to be another big movie time around the holidays. Anything that's coming that you are particularly excited to see and that you think also that audiences will be excited to see?
You know, there's a film coming, that, you know, and this is the first film that pops into my mind, I'm not quite sure why, maybe because I just saw it recently, is not a film that would fit in this book. It's a smaller film. It's an independent film that would probably fit in my first book. But it's a really remarkably well-done film that I think audiences will really enjoy. It's a film called Sweetland. It's a story. It's set just after World War One in rural Minnesota, and it's about a mail order bride who is German, who is sent to the United States to marry someone in a Norwegian community. And because she's German and the community is Norwegian, and it's after World War One, there's enormous resistance to her. And it's about how that situation works out. It's really a beautifully made kind of unusual romance character study, and it's one to keep an eye out for. I mean, sometimes smaller, you know, the smaller films, smaller companies sometimes try and steer away from the holiday season, the fall, because that's when the big films come out. But this is a little one that's trying to test the waters, and I don't know when it'll get to this area, but when it does, keep an eye out for it. I think it'll be very successful.
Well, that's a film that for here in our community, we're fortunate we have at least one theater that shows what you might call art films, so that here we actually get a chance to see some movies like that. That's the kind of thing that I would expect. And in fact, it's called the Art Theater that I would expect to see at a place like that, and probably not in the multiplex.
Oh, no, it's not going to be there. But, I mean, like I say, this is a good little film. I mean, the bigger films are coming. You know, in some ways, you know, of all things, I'm looking forward to the new James Bond film because it's got a very good actor, Daniel Craig, as the star. It's got director Martin Campbell, who's made a couple of good Bond films. It's kind of going back to one of the earlier novels. It's kind of like, you know, early James Bond before he was James Bond, you know, James Bond the early days. The trailer looked quite good. I'm hoping that will be really kind of, you know, one of the things, again, one of the points about this book is that, you know, you see a James Bond film and you want a James Bond experience. And so often you don't get the experience you want. And I think with this film, you'll get the experience you want.
Well, it's interesting because there was a lot of controversy among people who care about such things. A lot of controversy, I think, that Pierce Brosnan had many fans. And maybe they felt that he got a raw deal because he was at least willing to go one more movie. And apparently someone decided, no, they wanted to go with somebody different. And here this was an actor that, what's his name? Daniel Craig.
A terrific actor.
To a lot of people, they'd say, well, who?
People said who to Sean Connery when he got the part, you know. And also, you know, I mean, I always think of there's a button on my computer that says refresh, you know. And I think what they wanted to do, I mean, even though Pierce Brosnan did an excellent job, was a terrific James Bond, I think they felt that those pictures were starting to become formulaic. They wanted to do something a little different. Again, it's like James Bond before James Bond. I think the tone is going to be a little edgier, possibly. It may not succeed. I haven't seen it. But, I mean, I think it's interesting that they just were not willing to rest on their laurels and say, well, we can get another film out of Pierce Brosnan, and even if it's not a great one, we'll make X amount of dollars because it's James Bond. They were willing to take a risk to do something a little different creatively with a valuable franchise, and I think that has to be applauded.
Yeah. I think that here I have a question here from somebody who's asking their question off the air, and I think it's an interesting one. For those people who criticize Hollywood for sometimes not being able to come up with new ideas, it deals with the practice of remakes. And it also makes me think about sequels as well. You can remake what was a successful film, but that doesn't necessarily guarantee a success. Or if you have one movie that does well, to do essentially a chapter two of the same movie, to do a whatever it is, number two or number three, or, you know, some of these series of films go on for a long time, way more than they should.
Way too long.
Why do studios do that? And do you think that that's likely? That thing that says, okay, this movie made money, let's do that again. Studios probably aren't likely to stop doing that.
They're not going to stop doing that. You know, again, it's strictly economics. It's, you know, basically, if you make a product that costs $100 million, you want any possible advantage you can get. You want any possible thing that both will possibly get audiences to come, or at the worst will make you feel better as you're risking all this money, that you're not on a fool's errand and that maybe audiences will come. And a remake of a film that was once popular, a sequel of a film that was popular, producers and studios feel they have a leg up on getting people to come if they see that in the ad. And they say, oh, I like Ocean's 11. I'll go to Ocean's 12. Well, Ocean's 11 is in the book. It's a charming film. Ocean's 12 was a fiasco. They walked through Ocean's 12. But it made a certain amount of money because everyone had residual kind of good feeling from the last film. Mm-hmm. That's what they count on.
And I don't know if you can think of a particular example. I think the thing that I think of is the Spider-Man movies, where some people thought that the second movie was even better than the first one. Can you think of any cases where sequels actually get better?
Yeah, I mean, I have, I think, in the book, I'm just looking at the table of contents, I think I have a couple of sequels in here that were quite good. The Spider-Man sequel, I think, is better than the original. X2, the X-Men sequel, was better than the original. Toy Story 2 was at least as good as the original. Sometimes a sequel will really work because it kind of frees people up and they can take chances and they can be exciting with it and not necessarily play it too safe. The fear with sequels, the risk with sequels, is you play it so safe that you get boring. And if sequels take a chance and are good at it, sometimes they are better.
Mm-hmm. These are the kind of movies that we're talking about here. Not only are they cost a lot of money to make, but studios are willing to spend a lot of money to promote the movies, to sell them. And forgive me, but I'm thinking about Tom Cruise, and I'm thinking about his private life, as much as a lot of people listening would say, I don't want to know. This case of where it appears that his off-screen shenanigans have hurt him and seem to have hurt the movies that he's in. Now, maybe those things don't really have anything to do with one another, but it does make me think about, when we're talking about here, you know, big budget Hollywood movies with big stars, whether the way that audiences feel about the stars as human beings and what they do when they're not up there on the big screen really does influence their choices when it comes time to sitting down there and, you know, looking at the paper and looking at all the movies they might go to, which ones they might go to?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard really to say. You know, first of all, you know, the last film that, you know, Mission Impossible film that Tom Cruise made, during the promotion of which he did all these strange things, that film, it didn't go through the roof, but it did very, very well. I mean, a lot of studios would be happy with the amount of profit that film made. So it's not clear how much all the talk about how people were upset with him and didn't go was just talk, or whether people actually stayed home. I'm not sure either way on that. But I think, on the other hand, it's undeniable. You know, we go to watch movie stars because we have a fantasy about them in our heads. We connect with them in a certain way. We imagine them to be certain kinds of people. And if we see them in their private lives being other kinds of people, it kind of corrupts the fantasy. And when we're thinking of spending our money, we say, well, I don't know, I thought that guy was like this, but he's really like that. Maybe I don't want to see him in a movie. So I think this is a risk that's run. This is why in the golden age of Hollywood, the studios kept their stars really under a tight leash publicity-wise. Their personal appearances, everything they did was very tightly controlled, because the studios feared that the reality of the actors' lives would keep people away, possibly, from their films. So this is something that Hollywood has worried about for, you know, 50, 60, 70 years. And, you know, it's still a worry. People haven't changed. Mm.
We have a caller. Let's talk with them in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Tell you that originally I kind of liked Tom Cruise as the example, but I found that his hypocritical stance with the whole anti-gun and I wish guns would go away thing, and then all he ever does is make gun movies, I found that the whole, you know, I want to... It just made me want to puke, and I quit watching his movies.
Well, there clearly, in this case, you know, it does have an impact. Again, you know, I say this is something that studios have always worried about, and clearly people do get turned off by what stars do, and they just don't want to see them in any context.
Well, I just wanted to, when you touched on that, I immediately dialed the phone, because Tom Cruise is the banner for that one for me, because of that. You know, here's a guy that wants to stamp out violence, and then all he ever does is violent movies. And it seems to me that if you want to stamp out violence, start at home.
Well, you know, people have very, you know, I mean, when they throw hundreds of millions of dollars at people, sometimes people just can't resist. You know what I mean? It's you know, it's hard sometimes for people to talk the talk and walk the walk.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Obviously, we struck a nerve. If I'd known, all I had to do was mention Tom Cruise.
the phone lines would light up like a Christmas beginning
of the show. Here's someone else, Champaign County. It's line number two. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I tuned in a little late, but did you talk anything about Alfred Hitchcock? I saw him, Dick Cavett apparently has come out, or someone has come out with a series of his interviews, and they had one of him interviewing Hitchcock. It was on yesterday, and that was so interesting to hear how he put together movies and how he transferred the feeling he wanted to get out of each scene. And I'd just like to hear your guests talk about him.
Well, I wish we had I wish we had Alfred Hitchcock around today. You know, his films are the kind of film that I'm missing. You know, really intelligent popular entertainments that were smart, that didn't talk down to audiences, that were exceptionally well made. I mean, Hitchcock was a man with enormous, enormous experience. He was a filmmaker to the tips of his fingers, and the films are immaculately put together. There is, you know, a film like Vertigo is as interesting today as the day it was made 50 years ago. I just wish we had him around today. He is just a master filmmaker, and someone who made great films that were very appealing to audiences that people turned out for.
Yeah, just there's really no one out there doing anything like that. Is there any director that even wants to make one and maybe can't find the funding for it or whatever?
Well, no, I mean, there's no one that good. I mean, you know, I mean, he was just, again, you know, he started in the silent era. I mean, one of the things that's changed about filmmaking is that directors in Hitchcock's era had a lot more experience when they, you know, they made a lot more films. It was because of the studio system, a lot more films were made. They were made more rapidly. And directors really made, I mean, someone like Hitchcock, like John Ford, they made upwards of 60, 70, 80 films in their careers. No one's going to get anywhere close to that. The economics of the business has changed. But if you make that many films, your skill really increases. It's like anything else. And these directors got really good at directing because they had so much practice.
Yeah. Well, just one comment, and I think I'll go to wherever, video store, and find bunch of his old movies again and start watching him again. Those were it's really interesting.
It's a great idea.
All right, thanks for the call. Let's talk with someone here this morning in Kankakee. Line number 4. Hello.
I'd like to throw out some names very quickly. Tim McCandless, Steve Soderbergh, Haley Joel Osment, Robert Duvall, Michael Caine. Secondhand Lions, could you talk about that?
I'm sorry, I missed that part.
Secondhand Lions.
Oh, Tim Secondhand McCandless, Lions. That was a sweet film. It's not a, you know, it was a smaller film. It was more like an independent film. It wasn't really, as I remember it, a major studio release. But it's a, you know, it's more the kind of film that would have fit in my first book. But it's a very nice film. It was very nicely done. And again, it's the kind of film intended for adults that just doesn't get put out there that much anymore.
About Mr. and Mrs. Bridge.
Oh boy, Mr. and Mrs. Bridge goes back even further. That's before the scope of the book. But that was Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward. Taken from the novel, also a very high-quality film.
How about the Merchant and Ivory partnership? What do you got to say about them?
Oh, I like them. I mean, everyone liked them. You know, Ismail Merchant died a few years ago, so those films will be no more, but they made, you know, some really wonderful films, really high-quality films, a lot of them set in England. Really, again, classy films that appeal to audiences, didn't insult people's intelligence.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And the previous caller talked about the, I'm seeing an interview that Dick Cavett did with Alfred Hitchcock. If people are interested in movies, and they have cable, the Turner Classics Network has been running a series of old interviews that Cavett has done with some celebrated people in Hollywood. He did a new one where he sat and talked with Mel Brooks, but he also has talked with, I saw one night, an interview he did with Woody Allen, one he did with Betty Davis, and they're really interesting to see these people talk in a relatively unscripted sort of way, but also because I think it's a style of interviewing that you really don't much see anymore.
Yeah, it was not in-your-face interviewing. It was more it was not like the Howard Stern show, you know. It was more conversational. It was an attempt to kind of elicit what was on the person's mind, an attempt to really see what the person was thinking and gets to share in their insights, people, you know, who had all this experience and all this knowledge, and, you know, what were they thinking? And I think, you know, that is a style of interviewing that's kind of going away.
Yeah. Well, we're unfortunately just about the time we're going to have to stop here because we have to spend a little time asking for support. The show ends up being a little shorter. For people who are looking for suggestions for movies they might want to see, you can look for the book Now in Theaters Everywhere, which is subtitled A Celebration of a Certain Kind of Blockbuster. So if you're looking for suggestions on that kind of movie, you can also look for the book Never Coming to a Theater Near You, which is about a different kind of movie. So either one, you could have both those books on your shelf, and you could say, depending on what kind of mood you're in, you go for one or the other. Our guest is Ken Turan. He writes for the LA Times and also does reviews for National Public Radio. Any last thing you'd like to leave with folks?
No, just not to give up hope. You know, there are wonderful films out there. It's hard to find them sometimes. There's a lot of nonsense out there. There's a lot of clutter. But don't give up on the movies. You know, the experiences you had that you treasure, you can have again.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to be here.
We certainly appreciate it, Ken Turan. And you can look for his reviews on Fridays here on AM 580 as part of Morning Edition. And you can go online and you can read his reviews in the paper. And, of course, you can look for his books in the bookstore.